Hey, Jill?
Yeah.
Your thing is really small on the screen.
That's because I'm not in presentation mode yet, because I'm still setting things up.
Okay.
Your phone is really buzzy.
Buzzy?
Yeah.
I got bad connection here today. I don't know what's going on. Is that better?
No.
I can still hear a buzz.
It's making a weird buzz. Miguel and Dr. Jones, we can see you. You don't need to have video on if you don't want it.
Yeah, we want the video. Well, we don't have to have the video, but because Miguel has his slides up on his laptop, and he can just do it himself.
So, but they're going to show the slides on here.
Okay.
So do you have them right, Jill, the slides, his slides?
I have everyone's slides, but connections are really bad. There's a lot of feedback.
And I'm getting an error on WebEx.
Okay.
Jill, but Ed, you're on WebEx, right?
Yeah, I'm on WebEx. That's fine. But I'm going to call back in. Do you think it's my phone that's buzzing?
Well, you were the first person I was talking to, but Dr. Jones' phone wasn't much better.
How about mine?
I mean, you're everyone's
fine.
Buzzing.
I don't hear a buzz.
Okay. Well, maybe it's my phone.
I heard it.
Okay,
so, you're not alone in this world with that.
I can't get into WebEx. Sorry.
You want to come to my office, Sarah?
No. I'll try to get it to work.
I can see Ken Jones's office.
Hello.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Not very well.
You're low volume.
I'm speaking right into the phone, so.
That's not very loud at all.
Are you somewhere good while you're talking into that phone?
Pardon?
Are you somewhere good?
No, I'm sitting in my office.
Oh, well, that's really depressing then. Okay.
Should I try to call back in?
Did you already do that?
No, I just called in the first time.
Why not?
All right, I'm going to hang up and call back in, all right?
Hello.
Dr. Jones?
Can you hear us okay?
Yeah, but you guys just want to be logged in on the phone. If you can turn off the computer audio, like you want to select no on WebEx for audio and video, because
okay,
we're getting some feedback.
Yeah, I've got the same problem, Jill. Let me just turn that off. How do I turn it off?
Well, when you join it.
Yeah, too late.
Pop back. Is that better?
Ed, no, not really.
Well, then there's not much I can do about it. I have a very weak signal here today for some reason.
Your volume, you're not buzzing anymore.
All right, well, we'll try it and see what happens.
You sound pretty clear to me, Ed.
Yeah, you're fine.
Okay, good. All right, so Michael's on. Jennifer? Christy?
Yep. This is Christy.
Cristiano?
Yes, I.
Claire? Joanne?
Hi there.
Jeff? Johan? Scott?
I'm here.
Ben Jones? Sarah, there?
Yeah.
Okay,
not on WebEx, though. I can't get it to open.
Tatiana?
I'm here.
Leah?
I'm here.
Mike Study?
Hello.
Sandra Mooney?
I'm here.
Tori?
Hi,
I'm here.
Tom or Kathy from NOPAC?
Good morning, Ed.
Hey, Tom. John Hannigan?
Present.
Sarah Jo, I heard. Dan Savage? Bill Dutty?
We are here, Ed.
Okay. Anyone that I missed?
Johan's here.
Jennifer's here.
Miguel.
All right, so I'm missing Claire Cole, Jeff Wozniak, Ken Jones.
Here, I'm here.
I'm here.
Ken's here.
And Miguel, too.
I'm Miguel. So, I'm sorry, did Jeff Wozniak, is he there?
He's going to be joining a little bit late, he said.
Okay, anyone I missed?
No, but I'm going to hang up and go into Jill's office because I can't get WebEx to work.
Okay. All right. The first thing I want to do today is to introduce our new program officer, Joe Wang, who is joining us on this call. And he's been recently appointed to take over as the program officer on all of the CPAPs. Grant. Joe received his PhD in molecular genetics from Ohio State, so he's a Buckeye. He did postdoc training in microbiology and immunology at the University of California, San Francisco. He's been at NIAAA since 2007 in the Division of Metabolism and Health Effects. And his portfolio basically consists of the role of alcohol immune interactions in pathogen infection and organ injury. So with his background in genetics and immunology, he should be of great help to us in CPAP with several of our projects that are in those areas. And I'm getting a big buzz. I don't know what that's from, but
there must be feedback from one of the phones or computers.
Yeah, so maybe if you could put your phone on mute for right now, that would help. All right, so we have a few just business things to take care of. And then what I wanted to do was to kind of review the project so that Joe could get an idea of what where we are, what we're doing, and bring him kind of up to speed on CPAPs and the various projects that are involved. And the only project that will not be represented is Tina's, as she's out at another meeting today.
Hey, Ed.
Yeah?
Hello, everyone. This is Joe Wong from AAA. Thank you, Ed, for that introduction. I really looking forward to learning from you guys, and the same process be helpful.
Well,
I would add that we're trying to bring Joe up to speed on the projects. He has reviewed everyone's progress reports that were submitted and looked at the website, so it will take a little time, but I think he's getting up to speed pretty quickly. So Joe will take over all the programmatic duties that I had as the program officer on the grants. So reviewing the type 5s, dealing with carryover requests and admin supplements requests, and I will assume the role that Dale had as project scientist as I mentioned, in Vancouver. And Dale, he's not on the call today, but he will still participate in calls and meetings when he can. So, thanks, Ed.
Sounds really reasonable. I look forward to continue working with you, Bill, and working with Joe as well. And and you know, now that you don't have to serve both roles, maybe life will get a little bit easier, and you won't have to hear from me as often. I've received most comments from the Science Advisory Board following our meeting in Vancouver. I need to edit those or continue to edit them, and then I'll be sending them out to each of the PIs so that you can see the input that the SAB had on the various projects. But that should be done within another week or so. I'm still waiting for one of the SAB members to respond, and hopefully I'll get those comments shortly. Everyone should have sent their RPPRs to Jill, since you've all submitted them to ERA Commons. And the other important thing to mention today is to please hold the date from October 27th to November 2nd open for our annual meeting of CPAS, where we're going to be meeting in the Rockville Bethesda area, and hopefully we will be able to talk to Dr. Koob and show him what we're doing, and so that should be an interesting meeting. We'll do it hopefully prior to any bad weather coming in. It's the only thing is it's going to be a little crowded at the meeting, since I think we have seats for 30 and 31 people in the room, so it might have to get a little closer, comfortable. But save those dates. We're going to narrow it down, hopefully to Monday or Tuesday, Monday and Tuesday, and we'll get everybody home that same day, hopefully. So save those dates, and that's about the issues. There's the other things. The progress tracking charts are available online. And then email Jennifer any news for the CFES website. We all know about these things. There's two new acceptances. I think Jill just put up online. New concept proposal coming in from Joanne. All right, so I want to go through the projects, and I'm going to start it off. So if Jill can get me up there, and everybody can hear me okay?
Yes.
Yes.
All right. Yep. Okay. Just waiting for my slides to show up. All right. So I head up the admin core, and since I can't control these, Jill, so you'll have to just go ahead. We're going to go through these quick. As I said, I'm the PI. Mike Charnas at Harvard is scientific director. Jen Thomas at SDSU helps me out with the admin core. And Jill Vanderveld, who you will come to know very, very well, is the administrative coordinator. Our science advisory board is John Hannigan, Sarah Jo Nixon, James Reynolds, and Dan Savage. And we would like to appoint a new member with a specialization in genetics. The three of you are the NIAAA advisors, and our steering committee basically all of the PIs on the various projects. In addition, we have affiliated scientists who had projects within CFAS at one stage or another, and now continue on, and because they wish to continue on, they have R01s rather than UO1s. And we're going to start hearing from them on our conference calls beginning in July, I believe. Next. So I think CFAS has been very productive. As you can see, already this year we have 8 publications out. We have a total number in CFAS. of 264. So I think we're doing very, very well, and a lot of his stuff's in fairly high-impact journals. So I'm very pleased with our productivity. Next. These are just those publications. And I want to point out that half of our publications include CFAS collaborations. So these are not just individual projects coming out of the UO1s, but they are really cross-project collaborations. And for at least half of the ones that appeared in 2019. So I'm really pleased with that. I think it shows how efficient and effective these consortiums can be. Next. This is something that if you do a search of the Web of Science using fetal alcohol, prenatal alcohol, or pregnancy and alcohol, and just look at the funding mechanism for those records that show up, all the ones with stars are CFAS investigators. So we're highly productive, and our grants seem to have an impact on the field. I mean, these are the top grants that are cited in those areas of prenatal alcohol exposure. And so I think that's pretty remarkable. There's only two that are not in the top 10 that have an impact or a relationship with CFAS. Next. We have some visibility. We just finished at the 8th International FASD Conference, which is probably the largest FASD conference in the world, and CFAS gave a whole morning session featuring most of its PIs. Next. Here we go through part two, and then on Friday we had additional plenaries there. You can see that almost all the CFAS investigators were involved in one way or another with this half-day symposium. And we do this every year. Next. In addition to that, we also had several of our members present 90-minute sessions at the meeting. So we got good exposure there. Next. We had good visibility at RSA last year, and I'm expecting that to continue this year. Next. Importantly, several investigators that related with CFAS won awards at the Fetal Alcohol Study Group. Sarah Matson won the Henry Rosetta Award. Nahal Salam won the Tim Cutt Award, and Alex Sang with the Anita Gordas Research Award. So I think we're doing pretty well. Next. These were symposium at RSA. Next. We had visibility at the international meeting in Kyoto, where we talked about genetic studies ongoing in FASD. Next. This is an upcoming symposium at RSA that Mike Charnas has been very good in putting together these symposiums. Next. We're going to be at ESPRA as well on pathophysiology and diagnosis of FASD. Next. We get in the headlines thanks to Jeff Wozniak, who was on PBS NewsHour. It got quite a big play and some follow-up news reports. And next. And Jeff just did it again, doing a podcast on NabNeuro on FAS spectrum disorders, which was, I think, about an hour long. And these typically get a large number of hits from neuropsychologists in training and practicing neuropsychologists. So Jeff's doing us real proud, and I appreciate it, Jeff. Next. This is our website, which you've seen, and Mike Charnas on the bottom there won the James Thorpe Award in 2018. So I think we get quite a lot of exposure, and I think we've done fairly well in getting the message out, being productive, and trying to get our research out into the public venue. So that's all I have to say. And then we can switch to Ken Jones and Miguel. And we're really on tight timeline today, so, you know, 3 to 5 minutes tops, guys. I hope I didn't go over. I can't hear anybody.
Are you muted, Ken?
Good morning. Yes, hey, can you hear me?
Hey, Miguel.
Hi, good morning. So, Ken Jones and I have been recently studying or trying to determine the validity of telemedicine in FASD. Yes?
The speech volume is really, not volume, it's just you're coming in really murky on my phone.
Okay.
Buzz, that's amazing.
And buzzing terribly.
Okay, how is that now?
Better.
Okay, so we have been recently working on proving the validity of telemedicine in for the physical diagnosis of FASD. We have used, on the one hand, pretty sophisticated telemedicine devices with sort of professional cameras, but at the beginning of the project, we also realized we should probably prove or try our common handheld devices, which would certainly come in much more handy for telemedicine approach. Next slide.
Hey, Miguel, if you're on speakerphone, if there's any way you can pick up and just speak into the phone, that might help.
Okay. Is that any better?
Yes. So much better.
Enormously better.
Great. So, as I said, we have used, as we saw in the previous slide, some pretty sophisticated telemedicine devices, but also we decided to add the common handheld mobile devices that can be used pretty much by everyone everywhere in the world. And so basically, next slide, our methods were to examine these children with those two techniques and also in both directions. That is, Dr. Jones would examine them physically, directly, twice, and I would be receiving the image both through the telemedicine system and through the iPad system, which we call Zoom, through a Zoom conference, a secure Zoom conference, and then the other way. So basically, we performed 4 exams on each kid, which gave us 8 sets of data to be able to compare. Next slide. And basically, we have completed 45 subjects. Because we added the sort of handheld devices later, we have complete data on 33. We have more exposed patients, and we are now finishing our control population to be able to reach our proposed number of 48. Time for the exams is between 6 and 12 minutes, and certainly during our practice, we have identified what technical factors and methods can best suit this method or this approach. So how far you need to put the camera and other things. Next slide. So basically, the convergent validity, which is actually the outcome of the study, is what one of us will examine physically in presence and send through the two telemedicine approaches to the other person and seeing how concordant this is. And what we see is that we are fully concordant for the diagnosis of FASD, that is the categories FAS, PFAS, or non-FAS, in 86%. The next slide. And what we basically saw is that the telemedicine devices give us a very high concordance of 93 or 94 or 93%. And really any divergence is in fact related to our own, next slide, intra-examiner divergence. So inter-examiner divergence. That is, for some of the features, the opinion of two informed professionals on the diagnosis are divergent, and we will see which. Next slide. and that is mostly related, really, to the philtrum and the upper Vermilion and to the scores between 3 and 4. Where is the cutoff? And how do we define that cutoff? Next slide. There were some, and here we can see the data in detail. Next slide. We realize the limitations. This is not real in a way, because normally it would be a non-expert sending the image to an expert to interpret. So this, because of that, the study has allowed to investigate our inter-examiner divergence and therefore the lack of a complete precision of the physical features. So next slide. And now we are approaching the rest of the physical features that are not part of the formal diagnosis, but that we know are clearly associated to FASD. Next slide. And in conclusion, telemedicine is a valid method. Common handheld devices do even better, which we like. The divergence is based on inter-examiner differences that derive from the fact that the features are subjective. And we certainly need to collaborate with the other groups in advanced 3D facial imaging and automatic or objective assessment of these facial differences in order to be more precise and consistent. Thank you.
Thanks, sir. Miguel.
Yep.
Okay, Mike?
All right. I think that leads quite nicely into what I've got to say. A lot of what we've been focusing on lately is the assessment of neonatal images, and this is really just trying to assess facial dysmorphology at the earliest possible time point. I mean, at that stage, you don't have much else to go on. Cognitive measures and things like that are pretty hard to attain, and if we can get an earlier diagnosis to early recognition of any sort of facial features that might be present, and then that's what we're trying to aim for. So we've got a clinic down in Brighton in the UK. We've so far collected over 300 neonatal images, and this is usually within the first week of life. And we've got coming at this from two avenues. One is we're going to have try and produce a full analysis and combine them with the past neonates as well. And another direction we're going to go in is trying to see how clinically relevant we can apply our techniques, what kind of clinical relevance we have. I've picked out one particular individual here. This is actually an individual exposed up to 32 weeks gestation, quite heavily, and the overall size is small, and a lot of the mid-facial flatness that we're seeing in some of our other data sets is present, and across the nose, and the retrognathia, the chin, is present in this individual. What makes this individual particularly interesting is there's a chromosomal imbalance that actually has an opposing facial phenotype. So we're sort of starting to pick out individuals and look at things case by case, and there seems to be coming out with some quite interesting results. Next slide, please. Another direction we're going in is trying to apply our techniques into the clinical workflow. And recently we've redesigned some of our software, the new implementation that we're trying to push into a UK faculty clinic at the moment, just for some sort of user feedback and testing with Dr. Roger Mukherjee. We've also integrated this software into some of the 3D imaging systems as well, so the Vectra from Camfield and their tablet-based system. And it will soon be fully automated when we start introducing some of our more recently developed machine learning tools that can identify points on the face, and we can derive measurements and then put them into shape models after that. So that's in the pipeline at the moment, coming along nicely. Next slide, please. So that's simply using what's called it's using convolutional neural networks to identify points on the face, and for that we can derive measurements, throw them into shape models, and then get an idea of shape dysmorphology. These generally, we're looking for features that really go beyond the cardinal features. I think you need 4 clicks for the, yeah. So, yeah, and again. Sorry, I should have made those, there we go. Yep, so this is as far as we've got so far. We're just about to validate the PFL measures that we're getting, and they're so far looking pretty good. Some automatically derived PFL measurements, so once we've really completed that, we'll start applying it to different data sets. And we want to recapitulate some of the previous studies we've done using this automated landmarking tool. Okay, next slide. In addition to that, we're looking at 2D analysis of features. In our previous analysis, we looked at the profile and found it was quite effective for detecting fast individuals compared to controls. We've got kind of a processing pipeline that means we can then extract the profile from a 2D image and throw it into a shape model. And then gives us a statistical analysis of shape of an individual and how close and relative to a control or fast mean they are. We've also got more sophisticated 2D analysis tools using deep learning and AI techniques similar to the sort of face to gene sort of style, and that's what we're going to start working on this coming year as all the data is coming in. So that's me. Keep it short and sweet.
Thanks, Mike. All right, Tatiana.
Okay, I'll wait for them to come up. So this is for both Leah and I. So let's go to the next slide. So this is just to orient. So this is for what we call DigFASD, so dissecting the genetics of FASD. I think everyone's familiar with the protocol. It's an online consenting protocol collecting basic demographic information about exposures, getting photos, and now you've just seen one of the ways that photos would get used, especially 2D photos. So the progress that Mike's making is really important for this project. And also saliva collection. If you can go to the next slide, much of what I'm doing is trying to address the challenges that we've had in terms of our recruitment. So our recruitment numbers are below where they need to be. And we used the Vancouver meeting to really identify ways that we could try to improve our process and try to increase our rate of recruitment. So we got a lot of really great feedback from some of the adults participating in the conference. One is that just the consent is too long, too challenging to read. So we talked about solutions, and so one is just to do it as video conferencing with the staff. So basically walk through the consent, do it more like you were across the table from the person, but instead do it through video conferencing. That's an easy one to implement, didn't require an IRB change. Also the idea of doing an online video, so that we've just started to explore. But if you go to the next slide, we think there's actually probably a more important solution, which is compensation and monetary incentives. So for a lot of the studies I do, that's not really a critical piece, but it's really clear in the studies that we're doing here for FASD that we have to have a compensation component. So what we did is we've gone to our IRB and we're waiting for approval so that we could pay up to $50 for completion of the study. And that would involve obviously not the consenting part, but the either completing the forms would have a compensation for that piece, uploading photos would have a compensation piece, and then the saliva. And then sort of a, if you did all of those pieces, that would get you then to the $50. I think we recognize that if we don't do that, we're not going to be able to hit our recruitment numbers. And so we've waited to redo our video and to do that adult video so that we would be able to describe the compensation piece and have IRB approval for that. The other things that we've done is identify other sites that can help with recruitment. So as part of the grant, we always had plans to try to recruit for Christy Petrenko and her project, and so we also now have a reliance agreement in place so that she can also recruit under our IRB. So she doesn't have to have IRB at her place. She can use our IRB and that online component for the study. We're also getting ready to recruit in the FAS clinic here at IU. And then at the Vancouver meeting, we also spoke to several people to try to see if we could also coordinate some recruitment with them. So I think it's a recognition from us that we need to have more ways to try to identify individuals if we want to hit our recruitment targets. Next slide. So then the last slide I've got is really just about genetics. And so once we have saliva samples, we'll talk about what can be done. And so these analyses are from samples that were collected from individuals in the previous rounds of CFAS. We've done whole exome sequencing in a subset of individuals, those that had clearly fetal alcohol syndrome and those that were alcohol exposed but had no evidence of FAS based on dysmorphology. And so we did, from whole exome sequencing, looked for rare variants that might be in burden contributing to either risk, as in CRIPAC, or perhaps protection. That is, variants that are higher frequency among those who have FAS, as you can see, gene carriers in that first CRIPAC example, those 23 individuals with FAS, where you've got some increase in rare variants. And then for KIP2A, where you've got individuals that don't have FAS that seem to be carrying some rare variants. So we've done some additional work looking at other phenotypes where we have variable numbers of individuals, whether it's tip of sample volume or cantabs to neurocytes, and have found some consistency there as well. So I think we're pretty excited about that, and that is something that we are kind of trying to evaluate, is that do we have enough data that we could get that ready for publication? And that's my last slide. Do you want to add anything, Leah?
Nope. Good.
That's pretty cool. Thanks.
Should I pull up Johan and Scott? Should I pull up Johan or Scott first?
Mine.
Probably Scott.
Okay.
All right. Real, the 5-minute time limit holds.
I'll be super fast.
Wow.
Okay. So this project is using mouse and fish, which really phenocopy the effects of alcohol, the craniofacial and brain effects of alcohol, to identify genes that that may contribute to alcohol susceptibility. And so we have a couple of different strains that show differential susceptibility to alcohol. So our initial study, next slide, Jill, please. Our initial study just looked at the baseline differences in embryos, and we've identified a number of differences in expressed genes using RNA-seq that Johan is following up in his fish. And a lot of them revolve around the PI3 kinase mTOR pathway as well as the P53 pathway. And next slide, Jill. And so, for example, if we expose wild-type mice, we get a certain number of birth defects. If we take out one or both copies of P53, we can really protect against those alcohol-induced birth defects. So next slide, Jill. Going on to our latest RNA-seq analyses, where we exposed the embryos to alcohol and then took them out and see how the two strains of mice respond differently. The 6J strain at the top, which is the susceptible strain, it responds by having nearly twice as many genes that are statistically significantly altered by ethanol exposure, as well as these numerous pathways in like ERK signaling, Wnt beta-catenin signaling. In comparison, the 6N strain, which is the resistant strain, after being exposed to alcohol, it has far fewer genes that are differentially regulated by alcohol and no canonical pathways that were differentially expressed by alcohol. And so we're working through these genes, and there's nearly 500 genes in the 6J, or over 500 genes in the 6J. And so we're working through them and working with Johan to help narrow down that list so that Tatiana can start to look at these candidate genes in her human populations. And that's it.
Thanks, Scott.
Yeah, I was just going to share a couple pieces of data about sort of multifactorial interactions that we're looking at. And so the first one here, it's a little complicated here, but so we're looking at interactions between the sonic hedgehog pathway, which you've heard a lot about, ethanol, and then just the chemical synergist that's in a lot of insecticides and things called PBO. And so if you look there at the little circles, those are the individual exposures, and basically there's no effect of these. I would note that this concentration of alcohol is actually half the concentration that we normally use in our analyses. And then if we go to the next slide, or the next click, and then when you combine these individual exposures, now you see that almost 100% of these fish have some sort of craniofacial defect. So we have interactions between alcohol, genotype, and other environmental factors, like other chemicals. And then on the next slide, again, looking at multifactorial interactions, this is a gene by environment by environment interaction, and I'm not showing you the individual temperature data, but here we have this mutant that we identified in the screen that's sensitized to ethanol, and temperature can greatly vary the effects of that exposure. And so I would point out, even though it's not here, the LRP13B mutant, you only see a dramatic facial defect at 33 degrees if there's no ethanol. So it's a pretty strong synergistic interaction. And so that's it.
Thank you very much. Pretty interesting.
Johan, the change in the temperature, that's not at time of exposure. That's during gestation?
That is the temperature sensitivity, the window of temperature sensitivity actually exactly matches its window of ethanol sensitivity, and so that it's just right sort of at the pharyngeal stage is when they're sensitive.
Okay. Thanks.
Uh-huh.
All right. This is Sarah. Jill and I switched places since we're sharing a desk at the moment. So I put in my AIMS, but I'm going to skip over them because everyone's familiar with them. Just a reminder that this is our decision tree that we developed in the last phase of CFAS, and in our current phase what we're doing is we've tabletized the decision tree and we're using it in San Diego and in Minneapolis, and these are the so far how many kids that we've been able to enroll in our study. We've got 200 between our two sites. We've got 206 kids enrolled in the decision tree that I'm very proud to say. I think this might be the first time I'm at 108% of my goal. And these are the basic demographics. And then we give also a subset of subjects. Well, we ask everybody, but a subset of subjects are participating also in our validation test battery where they come into the lab and do a neuropsych test battery. We're doing that also in San Diego and Minneapolis. And we are ahead of our goal for this year as well. So really proud of the progress that Jeff and my lab have been making on this so far. So this is just a little bit of information, and I think I shared some of this in Vancouver, so I'm sorry if it's a repeat, but just to look at how we've been, what kind of data we get out of the tree, this is looking at the results of the tree, so it tells you whether the algorithm thinks that the child is alcohol exposed and affected or not, and then we have a small subset of kids who we have incomplete data for. So my mouse works. So along this axis we have the history of alcohol exposure. So here we have kids where it's really unknown. This is suspected and this is confirmed exposure. You can see there's not a lot of difference here between these two groups. And we're seeing, you know, the largest number of kids coming up as where the algorithm thinks they're exposed, so confirming what we know about these subjects. Now, in these kids, the no information, for those kids, we don't know what the right answer is, and so it's hard to know, although they are coming to a project where they know we're recruiting for prenatal alcohol exposure. So my guess is that they're telling us they have no information, but they have some suspicion. They're just ticking the no box instead of the, yes, I suspect there's exposure, and here's why. We've looked at the results of the decision tree. We also get a risk score coming out of the decision tree algorithm, and we've looked at the relationship between the risk score and an ARND checklist, and we see risk score of 4 and 5 indicates high risk, and we see, and then 0 and 1 0 and 1 are low risk, and then 3 is 2 and 3 are intermediate, and we see a nice correlation between our risk score and the ARND checklist. We've been looking at applying the decision tree to a low-risk sample using the COFAS San Diego data, we're doing pretty well in terms of our ability to identify people with diagnoses along the FASD spectrum, except where ARND is concerned, and there we're just
pretty abysmal. And I've been talking to, I talked to Ken Jones about this, I talked to Claire Coles, and we're still trying to process this. I think part of it is that the decision tree only takes into consideration behavior and not cognition other than IQ, and you can get a diagnosis of ARND based on cognition other than IQ, cognition impairment other than IQ, and I think that's where the difference is, and I've looked at that a little bit. Let's see, I'm going to skip over that. One of the things that we're working on along those lines is trying to come up with a way to identify or to use our tree data to help us help the clinicians identify a child who might have ARND. And so we, this is just two sample cases of a child who comes up in the tree as having been, both been affected by preterm alcohol exposure, but requires additional testing because we know they were exposed, but they're not coming up as having ARND, whereas this is a child where we know they're exposed and they are coming up with a diagnosis of cognitive impairment. I know I'm really short on time, but I'm happy to talk to anyone about this at another time, and I think that might be, oh, our future directions is we're working on the online neurobehavioral screen that's going to be deployed as part of the web portal that Tatiana talked about, and we're making some good progress on that. We're going to be incorporating both behavior and cognition in that, and that's really what we're focusing. While the data are being collected on the decision tree, that's really what we're focusing efforts on right now.
So, okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to apologize because we are running out of time. We're not going to finish everybody. So either try to keep it brief or we will have to do the rest of the projects when we run out of time. So any ones we don't get, we'll start off with at our next conference call. All right, Jeff?
Okay, I will try to be brief here. So just an update on our numbers. Reminder, this is the neuro imaging project where we are imaging kids and teenagers twice over a span of 15 months. So we are very, very close to finishing the first phase of this. And so you can see that we have 58 enrolled. We're at 97% of our target for May and about 64% of our overall target. So doing very well with recruitment. We're focusing this particular time on controls, and so my research coordinators are off to a conference this weekend to recruit controls for this study. All in all, things are going well. We've started the longitudinal part two, and that is the 15-month scan, so kids are now coming in for those second scans, and we're doing a brief cognitive evaluation and a rescan on the MRI. Next slide, Jill. Jill, can you go to the next slide? There we go. Okay. So I mentioned this previously that we are working on getting the structural imaging data in a very, very simple format up to the RedCap database at Indiana. We're still working out a couple of kinks, but basically we're able to export this data in RedCap format. And as soon as we work out the data dictionary and some of the field information, that data will be available to the rest of the CFAS investigators. This, just to give you a sense of the scope of this is about 790 variables that have to do with different brain structures in terms of the volumetrics and the surface area on the cortex, cortical gyrification, as well as thickness measurements all across the brain. So that data will be there very soon, as soon as I can figure out the technical issues. Next slide. We're working on the myelin data, and I have a new person working on this. This is just to give you a sense for the fact that we can map intracortical myelin at a voxel-wise level. So these are what the maps look like. And if you go to the next slide, Jill, we're starting to do some initial analyses of these data. These maps up at the top where you see the yellow on the cortex are showing areas where we can detect differential relationships with IQ across our controls and our alcohol-exposed populations. And this is in intracortical myelin, so we can now look across all of these regions across the surface of the cortex to see what's the relationship between myelination and something like IQ. We can do any number of other variables, but and then look at it differentially across our two groups. Next slide. This is just to show our collaborations. I won't go through all these other than to say that we're sending blood to Joanne still. We're still collecting those. We're collecting blood for Rajesh Miranda's project, collecting faces for Mike Suddy's 3D facial project. Dr. Jones has been here to see some of our kids, and as Sarah mentioned, we're collaborating closely with the neurobehavioral project. Next slide. This is just a little news note that I just did a podcast recently for neuropsychologists. This is available as of April 18th. It's the Navigating Neuropsychology Postdoc podcast. It's really listened to by neuropsychologists and trainees, and my understanding is that they are upwards of 1,000 downloads for each of these episodes and climbing pretty quickly. So it's an hour, more than an hour long, very dry and boring for most people, but it gets the our message out to a group of people who come in contact with kids with FASD. And that's all I have.
Thanks. Before we move on, we have about 10 minutes left for the hour here. Are there any questions from the NIAAA folks? Any comments? Or are we good to go?
I think we're good. Thank you. This is very good.
Okay, Joanne, and again, like I said, we have only 10 minutes, and so I apologize to people whose projects we won't get to. So, Joanne, real concise as you can be. Okay, I can't hear you.
Unmute yourself, Joanne.
Sorry about that. Is that okay?
Yeah.
Okay. So just to bring Joe up to speed, our grant has two parts to it. The first part focuses on children, the second on adults. And in the first part, we're going to look at matched mother-infant and mother-child pairs, as well as a child cohort from Jeff, as he mentioned, and I wasn't planning to talk about that at all today. The second part brings the study into adulthood, where a very understudied area, and we are recruiting adults with FAS, with ARND or FASD and a cohort of controls. And in parallel, we are working with Claire Coles and Therese Grant, who are recruiting similar cohorts, 120 individuals total at each site. And we will be able to combine the data in multiple ways, which will be very exciting. Our focus is on health and the immune system. So we have an extensive demographic and health survey. We're taking blood for measurement of cytokines and other inflammatory markers. We're collecting saliva for Tatiana's project. And we are also administering a variety of instruments to assess executive function, attention, adaptive function, daily living, and so on, to see how health and inflammation and changes in the immune system, to first of all, to see what they're like, and secondly, how they relate to overall function. The recruiting has gone well. We have added 7 participants since our RPPR was submitted. We have 1 scheduled tomorrow and several more already on the books, 33 to date. When we have a total of 40, we can run our first cytokine plate, and similarly, when we get 40 samples from each of the other sites, we can do that. And we're hopeful that by RSA, we'll have some preliminary data where we can begin to look at inflammation, health outcomes, and cognitive and adaptive function, and perhaps do some comparisons among sites. So that's where we are with this part of the study. Next slide. Just a few other points to mention in terms of progress. As Ed mentioned, we have a concept proposal submitted on the child paper, which is moving along quickly. We have a symposium at RSA ideas from John Hannigan to look at a cross-center symposium. So we have the symposium is focused on neuroimmune function, health outcomes, and FASD, prenatal alcohol exposure. We'll have Erin Milligan from the NMARC in New Mexico, Tamara Duran of Fitzwater in the DRC in Binghamton, and two people from my group, Charlie Zarnicki and Tammy Bodner, who are part of both CFAST and Kids Brain Health. John will be the discussant. We presented at the Vancouver conference. They had mentioned that. And I'll also follow up to mention Tammy also presented in the microbiome plenary and for the Sterling Claren Award. So that is our progress to date.
Thanks, Joanne. Claire?
Yes, I'm here.
Oh, to it.
All right. This is very quick. I've replaced the previous pictures of young people with in the study with the current subjects who are being sent off to Mike. And they're all from Atlanta because I didn't find out about this fast enough to get any from Seattle, but there are a bunch of people from Seattle, too. And as you all know, what we're doing, we're following up people who are prenatally exposed or have a diagnosis of FASD from childhood through middle age, basically. Next slide. Next slide, Jill. Okay, and that didn't come out right. That's the trouble with that. There we are. As of now, REDCap tells me there are 190 people who have completed the health survey, which is tier one of what we're doing. And this is an overall health survey, and 129 people have agreed to be in the registry for future research. This just gives you a picture of their demographic characteristics to date. We have, as you know, piloted and implemented this health survey, developed and initiated a tier two, which Joanne described, created an electronic data collection instruments, and implemented a couple of supplemental studies in Atlanta and Seattle that could blossom because of the fact that CFAS was here. And we provided samples to Vancouver and Indiana and also to facial imaging. Next. Next slide. A little bit of sample. It is too early in our data collection for Tier 2, which is designed to collect 120 subjects from each site as well as Vancouver. We eventually will have a very nice sample to be able to look at what's going on in adulthood, but we only started the Tier 2 data collection in January this year, so it's months early for that. This is just a little bit of a snapshot. As some of you know, we have a higher mortality rate than anticipated in Seattle, and we talked about this at the meeting in Vancouver, but essentially there's a high incidence of medically related issues that have occurred in the sample that was somewhat unanticipated given that the average age of this population is 36. We also found a higher incidence of incarceration than would be predicted, and this particularly in Atlanta. And this is particularly probably salient because this is a low-income African-American population where we, of course, know that there is an issue in that area. However, it appears to be more socioeconomic than FAS-related. Next slide. And, again, we're looking at drug exposure, drug use in this sample. We're finding that there is a good deal of drug use. And this from the data from March. More to the point, the most recent medical information, one thing we're doing in Atlanta, and I wish we could afford to do it in Seattle as well, is we're collecting information on cardiovascular functioning, and this is in concert with Dr. Cable's project, looking at vascularization. And I do want to bring to your attention that of the 19 people that we've run through that protocol, 12 have had medical problems that required us to make referrals. That's 63%, which is astronomically high among the population of this age. And we're talking here about people who have high cholesterol, high blood pressure, evidence of diabetes, all of it untreated. So it's an extremely high-risk situation here. I suspect, again, that this is related to some degree to the population we're working with, But I think that it's something that may be aggravated by alcohol exposure, and this of course, we'll be able to find out because of the contrast group that we have available. So that's where we are now.
Thanks. And if people can stay on a few more minutes, I think we can get through all of the PI projects and then do the developmental project next time. So, Christy?
Yep, I'm ready.
I'm ready.
All right, let's bring it. Okay, so you can go on to the next slide, Joe. This is just a summary, again, of the components of our app. We spent a lot of time in March going through this, so we can go ahead on to the next slide. This is the design of our study. We spent the first 2 years developing our prototype, which we demonstrated in March Vancouver meeting. We have now released it for beta testing, the iOS version. And if you go to the next slide, I can show you where we are with enrollment. So this slide shows where we have enrolled folks. So we have included in this initial beta test 21 parents. Those are by the red marker. Some of the sites have multiple parents, so there's not an exact number of markers. And then we have 18 providers. We are in week 3 of our beta test, and we'll go for 6 weeks. We have data collection planned for May, which will include both focus groups and interviews, as well as the data that's collected as part of the app use. We're set to present some preliminary data from this first round of beta testing at RSA. And so far, of course, there are a few technological issues that are coming up that we're troubleshooting, but it's been going pretty smoothly so far. So next, please. So as I mentioned, we have our first prototype going beta testing. I also have a complete draft of our manuscript on our focus groups that we presented data from in Vancouver. It's undergoing the editing, and we'll submit it hopefully in the next few weeks to CFAS for review before submitting to a journal, and then we'll be presenting at RSA. If you want to go to the next slide. So this coming year, we're continuing to refine the app in iOS based on the results of beta testing. We've been troubleshooting and adding a few features while we're beta testing, but with the results from the focus groups and interviews, we anticipate some continuing enhancements. We'll then complete and test the Android version. We'll do some beta tests with that. We have intent of analyzing and publishing the results from those beta testing trials. Cristiano's working on a manuscript of the technological development of the SMS Connect app, and we'll then move towards our feasibility trial and analyzing data from that as we continue to systematically develop and analyze the results from the app. And I think that might be it. That's our team.
Well, first of all, I want to thank everybody for being succinct and giving an overview of your project, and some of the recent data are very exciting. So I think we'll end it there, and we can have the developmental projects and Tina start up on our next conference call in May. So any comments from either the SAB or NIAAA?
None from me.
None from me.
None here other than thanking everyone for putting the talks together today.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, and it was a last-minute thing, so I appreciate the work that people did in putting these together, because we found out that Joe was going to be on the line. I thought it would be a good idea for him to hear from everybody, and hopefully next time everybody's in D.C., they can go in and say hi to Joe and put a face to a name, and all be good. So any other business that I'm forgetting about or whatever? If not, we're 2 minutes over our time. So, Michael, you have any last comments? Are you still there?
Just one word. Really impressive. Thank you all.
Okay.
That's all right, two words, but that's okay.
Impressive.
Thanks, guys. Bye.
Thank you very much, everybody.
Bye.
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 Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye.
Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye.